A lot of things are pretty much the manual process. I mean, you may have a little bit of automation inside of there where you're detecting things that are happening, but the portion of responding to it takes a bit of time because while you respond to it, you also have to mitigate things.
When you're developing an app, security might be treated as an afterthought. With functionality requirements and tight deadlines, it's easy to accidentally write vulnerable code or use a vulnerable dependency. But Sneak can help you secure your code in real time, so you don't need to slow down to build securely. Develop fast, stay secure. Good developer. Sneak.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. So we're talking about AWS security this month. Specifically, today we're going to talk about incident response. Now, incident response has not been covered that well across the globe in terms of just the cloud security concept. So I'm looking forward to this conversation with a really good friend of mine, Damien. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Pretty good. How about yourself?
Good. I'm really excited for this conversation, man, because I think incident response is one of those topics where people focus a lot more on how do we do threat detection, but not enough about, hey, how would we respond to this in the first place? So I'm really excited about this. But before we start, for people who don't know much about Damien, could you share a bit about yourself and how you got to your role today?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So hi, everyone. My name is Damien. So a little bit about me. So I've been in the security industry for about 4 years and counting. So my first role prior to this one, because this one is my second role as a cloud security engineer, was a security software developer for Verizon, which is a telecommunications company in the United States. So the majority of my work there, I basically just built a bunch of tools for like penetration testers and, you know, blue teamers, red teamers, be able to help them perform their daily tasks throughout the day. So I was pretty much a security tool developer the entire time. So one thing led to another. While I was doing that, I was getting exposure into AWS and I started to like doing things in AWS. So I got certified. So I hold about three AWS certifications, with my security specialty being the most recent one. And then from there, kind of pivoted into DevSecOps for the financial institution I worked for, and then became a cloud security engineer all at once. So that's pretty much how I got to where I am today in a very short and not long-winded way. So
yeah. By the way, it's a great one, because you're probably well-suited to kind of talk about incident response as a topic as well, because I guess a lot of people kind of can get confused. They think about pen testers when they think about incident response. Yeah. How would you describe incident response for people, specifically in the cloud context, because you've worked in that space more? How would you describe incident response in the cloud concept for people who may not have been familiar with it otherwise?
So just from a basic standpoint, incident response is pretty much, per definition, is the way an organization responds, detects and responds to threats within the organization, or that pretty much attempts to affect the organization. From a cloud standpoint, I would describe it as the organization's ability to be able to respond to cloud native threats. So that could also be in a way where they may have to leverage third-party tools or the specific cloud-specific services in order for them to be able to contain or mitigate those threats within the cloud. Specifically AWS, there's a plethora of services that they've come out with for you to be able to detect threats, like Security Hub. There's also MACI, for example, for detecting S3, you know, threats for PII and data and stuff like that. So when it comes to cloud for incident response, it's really about which tools you need to kind of evaluate your risk or your threat landscape for your environment, and how you're going to use those to be able to respond to them effectively and efficiently. So
interesting. Would you describe that to be that different to, say, traditional incident response?
I would say it is a bit different, definitely, because my personal experience with incident response from a traditional standpoint is you have more control within your environment. A lot of things, like especially if it's on-prem, you will know the ins and outs of the servers that may have been compromised, or you know, the code web applications that may have been compromised, versus in the cloud, you're pretty much working with the CSP to be able to understand what's happening and what's going on and what services you can use or how you can respond to that threat effectively to be able to mitigate and protect your organization's assets. So from a cloud standpoint, it becomes exceptionally important to collaborate more with not just the people within your organization, but also the CSP.
Interesting. And I think it's perfect timing as well, because we're kind of recording this as we are coming close to AWS Reinforce and for Cloudsec and all that as well. Just for people to get an idea of, because you're doing a talk at both places. I'll link to the talk when it gets available online so that people can go and listen to it. But in your talk, you were talking about how the incident response plan can take a few hours. I mean, I'm just thinking from a perspective that, hey, I come to you saying, Damien, there's an incident. Hey, man, I need your help. And you're starting from ground zero. There's a lot to be done in the beginning just to understand the scope of it and all of that, which takes hours. And then you're trying to like do this automatically. But you were saying in your talk that you've been able to reduce it quite a bit. So before we go deep dive into the talk itself, what's an average time for incident response usually that you see among when you talk to colleagues and otherwise just across the industry that you've seen?
So usually, because a lot of things are pretty much the manual process, I mean, you may have a little bit of automation inside of there where you're detecting things that are happening, but the portion of responding to it takes a bit of time because while you respond to it, you also have to mitigate things, right? So I would say average, like if there was an incident that happens, the detect and the analysis phase pretty much takes between like 1 or 2 hours. Mm-hmm. It's the containment and the recovery phase of it all that takes the longest time, because that phase, which is where in my talk, I'm talking about automating just that particular phase, because that phase of the incident response lifecycle takes the longest. And on average, containment, the timing is going to depend on how many services were compromised and how many things you need to mitigate or you need to save. Like if someone walked in there and decided to pop 500 IAM roles or they leveraged 500 IAM roles to create pivot points in your environment, you have to contain all 500 of those IAM roles. So that could take you quite a bit of time, because if you're in AWS, for example, you have to create a policy. So you have to go through navigating various different screens. You have to associate that denial policy to that IAM role, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just for one role. So imagine doing that 500 times.
Yeah.
Insane, right?
Yeah, that's insane. And I think I can already imagine, because it's funny, a lot of people imagine the scale of incident response on-premise to be very similar to, hey, how bad can it really be? But I think the 500 IAM role is a great example. Because I think when one of the conversations that I've had with a CISO friend of mine ages ago, and we were talking about how automation is like a double-edged sword. Great for when you want things to work, but when you don't want the thing to spread out, it would still spread out everywhere in all the accounts you have. And you're like, oh my God, why would this automation work?
Exactly.
So I can see how it can become a job that could be really hard without automation. I'm curious, what kind of services can people, and I know we're talking specifically about AWS as well, but I'm sure other cloud service providers have other services, but from an AWS perspective, because it's AWS Security Month, what services did you end up using from AWS for making your incident response activity automated and, you know, going about it?
For sure. So some of the services that I leverage for creating this framework that we developed is step functions for one. So step functions allow us to be able to pass in payloads and trigger a Lambda function, which is the second one. And that Lambda function in itself, you know, when you have a step function that invokes a Lambda function, it becomes very much scalable, because that Lambda function has the ability to be able to reach into the account that's possible by assuming, of course, a privileged IAM role to be able to execute a specific amount of containment actions for a given resource.
Yep.
So when you really sit down and you think about it, it's really step functions, IAM, Lambda. And there's also, if you want to send out any kind of emails or stuff like that, there's SNS and SES. SNS is very much so a lot faster. So SNS for, you know, people who subscribe. If you have stakeholders you want to subscribe to a topic, you can have them subscribe to the SNS topic to get that email.
Also like a page duty version.
Yeah.
And out of curiosity, because I think you said step function, Lambda, IAM roles, because most incident response documentation that I see, and I'm sure the audience would be seeing, would be around EventBridge. Why not use EventBridge for this?
So when we're talking about, you can use EventBridge from a detective standpoint. So a lot of what I've seen in the industry is a lot of people use EventBridge to build out their detective solutions like guardrails, which allow them to be able to traverse and detect things in negative activity or malicious activity within their AWS environments. But the framework that was pretty much that I talked about previously is more or less focused on just that containment portion of it, which takes the longest time. But EventBridge is something that you can use, and we could potentially use that for containment or automating a containment, you know, the containment phase of the incident response lifecycle.
Yeah.
My big thing is that if you were to do something like that, you would have to include some advanced artificial intelligence or NLP, because you will want something And the reason why I'm saying this, because I have a little bit of experience writing models and stuff like that for security purposes.
Okay.
You would need something to classify the event and automatically categorize the event to see if it is actually worth responding to. And that's something that as the human being, when we're at the fort, when we log into Splunk and we see something and they're just like, oh, well, someone created this EC2 instance and didn't enable IAM DBS version 2 or something like that, right? You know for a fact that you have to discern, okay, what's the priority compared to, well, we may need to actually respond quicker to this S3 bucket that has public access enabled, right? Because of course, this may contain
sensitive information or something.
Exactly, sensitive information that could be exposed, right?
Yeah.
So those are the things that you really want to sit down and you want to think about, but the human is the person that's thinking about it. So when you add something like that, you want to create and automate the entire lifecycle. You have to add some type of classification methodology to be able to classify, you know, your incidents and what things you want to respond to and what things you don't want to respond to.
Yep. Awesome. I think as you were saying it, I'm like, actually, I mean, to EventBridge as a great service as it is, it can look into every single event. Now, even just a simple event of create S3 bucket, that could be multiple possibilities. Like, I mean, you're talking hundreds of possibilities why someone created an S3 bucket, but how do you even see which one is malicious versus which one is good.
Yeah.
I mean, that definitely sounds like a problem to solve, but a complex problem. So I can see why step function probably makes more sense as well, because then you're more aware of what you're doing and how much you want to, I guess, scope out. Because I'm talking about scoping as well, in terms of environments, I'm assuming the thinking that would have gone behind making this incident response plan, or at least the containment of it, would have had things like your, I'm thinking more from a perspective, because most AWS environments would be multi-account. And I'm sure that comes with its own challenges. And maybe before we even deep dive into the whole multi-account challenge, you kind of mentioned two phases. And I think I want to just quickly just tap on how you think about incident response, that way people get to see why we're focusing on containment as well. So what are some of the stages you think about in an incident response plan? Because people who are listening in, I imagine some of them are leaders who are trying to figure out, hey, I need to make an incident response plan. You mentioned containment as one phase. What's before that and what's after that? And so is it like a sequence to it?
Yeah, there's pretty much a sequence. So in my mind, when I look at it, and I don't necessarily have like the full like NIST plan, but I would say if you are trying to construct your incident response plan, definitely look into the NIST IR lifecycle, because that's going to have like a full guided list of things that you should do when you're constructing your incident response plan from scratch.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to this, the containment, the eradication and recovery phase, which is pretty much all in one. Before that, there's the detection and analysis phase. And then after that, there is the, okay, lessons learned. What did we do? How do we do it? How do we prevent things from happening after the fact? And that's where those are pretty much like my three phases in my mind. There's the detection analysis, containment and mitigation phase, and then there's the lessons learned phase. And without the lessons learned, of course, you're going to repeat the same problem. And then in order for you to have the containment, you need to be able to detect and also analyze what events are happening in your environment and classify them.
Yeah. And I think to your point also, the learning would also help improve the threat detection as well, because then you can detect for them and all. So cycle. So talking about containment specifically, for people who are starting on this, like, oh, Damien, great talk and everything, I want to start doing this. What were some of the first thinking that you had as you were kind of going down the journey of working on this? Also, what were some of the challenges?
So from a containment standpoint, honestly, I walked directly into a tool that was automatically, I would say, pre-built. But I would say my biggest challenge was really just kind of understanding the threat landscape of containment. Like, okay, what is it that we're containing? How would we be able to do these things? What permission sets we need? And most importantly, how is this going to scale? And just those 4 to 5 questions really kind of identify the scope as far as like, you know, okay, we know for a fact that we need something to automate because we need to scale, which is most important. We definitely need to know that there are going to be multiple use cases for this because there are multiple services. And for every service, you need some type of capability to mitigate any kind of threats for it in AWS specifically. There is the aspect of getting those permissions, right? Most organizations will have SCPs in place. And of course, I'm sure they may have like a centralized IAM team to work with. You'd have to figure out how you can get those things whitelisted. And then the last thing would be from a deployment standpoint, how do you get this into every account? Mm-hmm. How do you have something in a centralized account? How do you allow that Lambda function to reach into various different accounts to contain resources? How do you do that? And that right there, the two biggest challenges that I faced was, in fact, from a containment standpoint, was roles and permissions and identifying the permissions. And then the second thing was the deployment strategy for this. Because if you have an organization, I'm pretty sure, like you said, there are multiple accounts, right? That an organization will use in AWS. The question is, how do you get this framework kind of deployed into every different account?
Yeah.
And that is something that you have to work with, especially if you have a DevOps team. They most likely are using AWS Landing Zone to deploy various resources, but that's a challenge within itself. How do you get that?
I mean, I think because I kind of stopped at the part where, Lambdas can be deployed anywhere. But then as you kind of called it out, I'm also thinking from a, like, if we just go back to the example of 500 IAM roles and each of those roles created an EC2 instance, and you're like, oh, wow. So I've got 500 times 500 EC2 instances and all of them in multi-account, multi-region. And you're like, oh, wow. Like, I think the scale just amplifies. And you're like, oh, my tiny little Lambda function cannot go through all the accounts and all of them. And I mean, even if you're going to go down the path of using step function and Lambda and everything, you're trying to figure out, I think, I imagine encryption would be a challenge as well. Because I remember AMI was like, oh my God, it's going between one region to the other. I mean, I understand why they have that, but did you have that challenge as well?
I also designed and developed a little bit of automation around the forensics phase, which is basically collecting snapshots. So yes, I did face a lot of challenges relating to the forensics aspect of collecting snapshots because, you know, KMS keys or CMKs are regional services.
Yep.
It's a regional key. So you have to create one in every region. The problem is when you have it from an IAM standpoint, let's say if I wanted to collect a snapshot for an EC2 instance that's hosted in a different account and I wanted to copy that into another account by using another KMS key. The role that you're using has to have permissions to de-encrypt, decrypt, re-encrypt, and also generate a data key for that KMS key in the tenant account.
Yep.
And if you're using a different CMK in another account, it has to have permissions to that too. But that's not all, because the CMK itself has a key policy. So you also have to make sure that that key policy grants your IAM role the permissions to do that. So it's a lot of grants. You have to create those grants, and you have to make sure that your keys themselves have permissions to give your role the rights to do what it is that you need to do. So it's a bit convoluted, but it can be done.
Well, you, do you talk about this in your talk as well?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I think because I was going to say, in terms of like, what's a 30-second version of how would someone achieve this, I guess, or maybe a longer version, that's okay as well.
I would say like this. If you have an organization that has multiple accounts and you have, let's say you have multiple accounts, of course, it would be ideal to start at the very foundational level to include those things. So what I would suggest is that, and this is based on my experience and also is incredibly opinionated, you have a module, for example, we use in Terraform, you have a module that everyone uses to be able to deploy a KMS key into their AWS accounts. If you're restricting them to using just that module for your KMS keys, your S3 buckets, so on and so forth, you can modify that module to allow a specific amount of roles to decrypt, encrypt, re-encrypt, et cetera, for that particular KMS key or that subset of KMS keys. And that will help eliminate the overhead of going in and manually updating the KMS key policies for every key that in the organization that is used. It's something that you bake into the SDLC.
Okay, right.
The deployment strategy.
And, so as a step towards containment, you're basically adding that IAM role to be part of that. As in, obviously, everyone can choose to have this in the beginning, but if they don't, they can still just update the Terraform, basically update the IAM role. It's everywhere, and then you can run your step function to kind of just get the whole thing going.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because that would, to me, make sense. But would you still be able to kind of copy across? Because you kind of have to almost like you're decrypting, unencrypting, copying in the snapshot across, then re-encrypting. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Because I think, at least because I remember when we were trying to do the whole golden AMI thing, and we were trying to just be, hey, we will just use one golden AMI everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then we decided against it because we're like, we're just transferring between region was just like such a headache. Like, cause, well, if I'm already unencrypting it, then what's the point? So that's kind of where the, a lot of the questions came in. Like, the more we use encryption, the more we're confusing ourselves. But yeah, I, the audience would get the point. Basically, yeah, watch out for encryption as you kind of walk across. Would you also be covering in your talk around how will someone structure this? Because you know how AWS has recommendations around have a separate account where you have all your forensic tools, all your everything that, just that deep dives into every account. There's a potential incident. Is that the kind of like, A, did you end up using it and did you find that valuable?
So we ended up following a similar pattern wherein we have, for example, the framework is deployed into a security account just for it.
Yeah.
And then all of the other like resources that we have that we wish to contain are obviously in our AWS tenant accounts, right? So in a sense, the framework exists in one account. We have our forensics accounts for forensic analysis. And then there's also just the customer accounts where we can have the ability to be able to reach into to perform any kind of containment or collection action. So we followed a similar process. So, and it definitely worked out well, I would say.
That's pretty awesome, man. Maybe just to put some more color onto this painting, if you can probably give an example of, because let's just take the three popular services that people usually have in AWS, AWS EC2 instance, S3 bucket, even just if we take those two, how can someone approach doing containment to these services? Because I think maybe if you talk about the containment process, just as you were explaining it, how would one start about doing this for EC2 instance?
That's a great question. So from an EC2 instance standpoint, I would say mostly the idea for me for containing something is to completely break it and make it unusable. So of course, I'm pretty sure there are people who are probably not going to agree with me on that statement, but you don't want anyone to have access to it at all, unless of course they're security professionals, right? So in my opinion, when you contain an EC2 instance, the first thing you want to do aside from detecting it and evaluating it to make sure you have the right EC2 instance is you want to completely disassociate the instance profile from it and remove any IAM roles that it has so that it can't necessarily, you know, let's say if you have an EC2 instance that connects to an RDS instance or something like that, you want to make sure that it doesn't have any kind of permissions to do anything. The next thing that you want to do is considering if your EC2 instance, it has network connectivity, which in most cases it will be. You want to remove all of the security groups and attach a deny all security group to it. That prevents it from being able to connect, prevents inbound and also outbound traffic. So don't include any rules at all. The final two things I would recommend is apply a termination protection policy. And that stops the attacker from trying to clean up their mess automatically. And then the last thing is that you want to stop it from running so that when you take that snapshot, it's not running. So you have a whole bunch of, like, say, for instance, you have a web application running on it and it can't connect to anything. It most likely will fill up your error logs, right? So you want to be able to just stop that from happening and stop the instance from, you know, running so that you have a nice EBS instance of volume so that you can copy that into your forensics accounts to perform that analysis purposes. So that's what I would recommend for containing an EC2 instance.
Awesome. And snapshot of the EBS volume as well, or?
Absolutely. For forensics capabilities, take that snapshot of that EBS volume so you can analyze it. You can check it out and see how the attacker was able to penetrate, how the attacker was able to get in.
If you're watching this Cloud Security Podcast episode on YouTube, Twitter, or LinkedIn for the second time or third time, or maybe have been a long-term viewer, I would really appreciate it if you can hit us the subscribe or follow button on your popular social media where you watch it, which is either YouTube, LinkedIn, or Twitter. It helps us get discovered by more people, but it also helps the speakers who are coming onto our podcast to know that their time would be valued by helping people like yourself so they can share their perspective and get more help for yourself in any cloud security problems you're trying to solve, or a skill set in cloud security that you're trying to upskill in. Let's get back to the episode. This is not like a service. It's just like a volume attached, but it acts like a RAM. I don't know if it's still the case, but essentially it was like a RAM attached to
memory.
So can you still access memory and stuff? Is that still allowed in AWS?
Or? I believe so. Don't quote me on that. I believe so.
Because I imagine from a forensic perspective, that's also like a lot of juicy information as well, right? What was done, because memory would have stored things that it's trying to cap, whether it's clipboard or whatever else, maybe information that would be there in the memory of that, that would be valuable as well. So people can actually include that as well if they want to.
Yes, they could, like, if, for example, like if we were to contain an EC2 instance and you stop it and don't terminate it, you still have all that information there. And because it's isolated, you don't necessarily have to worry about anybody connecting to it. But yeah. I will say this. There is a way for you to get into the instance if you allow, if you assume a role and have SSM permissions.
Yeah.
And that's where you can do the memory analysis if you have that SSM capability to log into that EC2 instance. Yeah. So I think I know what you're saying.
Yeah,
I think
that's
kind of like one of the ways that you can do it.
Interesting. Yeah. And what about S3 buckets? And I think we hear a lot of use cases. I think we had one of the guests in the past talk about whole ransomware in S3 buckets as well. I couldn't believe this was ransomware in S3 buckets as well, where basically people empty the entire S3 and leave their Bitcoin as a text file. You're like, hey, just my address. And you're like, okay. But clearly there are incidents that happen in that context as well. Uh-huh. So from an S3 bucket perspective, what's the plan of action there from a containment perspective?
Oh my goodness, I have so much wealth of knowledge for that. So there's two things. I have an open source project that I've developed called DataCop. So it essentially contains an S3 bucket after you leveraging Macie.
Okay, yeah.
And also now Trend Micro. A big shout out to Trend Micro for file storage because their tool also allows you to be able to scan for malware against their own private like signature repository. Okay. So when it comes to containing an S3 bucket, I'm so glad that AWS decided to update their security specifications and policies for S3 because now public access is now disabled by default, which is great. Yeah. Back then it wasn't. So before then, a lot of people would create these S3 buckets and of course public access would be enabled because they didn't know how to disable it, right? And that led to a lot of things. But when you are attempting to contain an S3 bucket that is potentially malicious or has been compromised or popped, I would say the key thing is that you want to make sure that first thing is public access is disabled. You don't want anybody, you know, anyone from outside of your organization traversing through your S3 bucket. That's the first thing. And the second thing is the beautiful thing about S3 is that you can have an IAM role that you can use to be able to view them, but you can still, if your bucket policy is by default takes precedence, so you can restrict anything from happening if you update your bucket policy. So the next thing is that you want to restrict or deny all S3 access to that bucket by adding a deny all S3 bucket policy and only allowing explicit security roles to be able to assume a role into your account to view the S3 bucket and then collect any kind of analysis or anything like that. So you can conduct that. But that's my recommendation that I would say to kind of move forward with containing that is revoke all public access to it. And then the next thing is create that bucket policy, deny everyone except for security roles. So
interesting. And no, thank you for sharing that, man. I think that's definitely good because I think denying public access is really number one for most things, especially if you know something has happened as an incident. Talking about incidents as well, I imagine, you know how we started the conversation with just the conversation about fact, not many people even talk about incident response in the cloud context because they just assume it's already been taken care of or AWS would respond to them or something would happen. Yeah. 9 out of 10 times, audience members, it does not happen. You kind of are still relying on yourself and your threat detection capability to even identify that has happened.
Right.
So for people who may have not even walked down this path and they hear you talk about this, they hear you talk and go, oh my God, I need to work on this. What are some of the good, I guess, building blocks for building an incident response plan that you would say? Obviously, we spoke about the three phases, which we can look at, but what are some of the easy wins? I feel like it's a daunting task to even start thinking about, oh, I'm going to build a castle, but I haven't even made a brick yet. So I think that's kind of like where I feel most people would get overwhelmed by the incident response thing. So do you have some recommendations on people trying to build incident response plan for where they can start?
If you're looking to build it, I will say the easiest portion to start with is the detection side of the house. Okay. Because when you start to look into how do I want to detect incidents in that process or in that discussion, those conversations that you have, you realize that you also need to threat model things. And that invokes another topic that you can dive into. Because when you start to threat model things, you also start to understand and classify your business, you know, critical business applications. You also start to classify if it's from an AWS service standpoint, which services you want to restrict, which services you want to recommend, and so on and so forth. So those are the type of things that you want to look into trying to build and try to develop in your incident response plan is start with the detective side. Get things threat modeled, have those discussions of what you want to allow in AWS, what services you want your individuals to use, and then from there, start maturing your process around building automation around detecting those things. Because if you have a list of services that you allow, you can start to threat model and create controls around those services, which those controls end up being detective controls and also preventive controls, right? So that's where I say start first. Don't hop to containment. Build your detective and preventive controls first. Then you can move into automating the next part of the incident response lifecycle, which is the containment analysis, so on and so forth.
Awesome. Great advice as well. And what about even, I feel like prepping for incidents is also some not spoken about enough. How can people go about preparing themselves for a potential incident? Like they make their threat detection, threat model, all of that.
Right.
How does one, it's almost like a muscle memory, for lack of a better word. People want to develop that as they go forward, especially in the cloud context. They may have a lot of experience in on-premise context, but cloud has its own challenges. What's your recommendation for people to keep on top of that?
So the best prepare yourself for incidents, I always recommend, is just paying attention to what's going on in the cloud security space or in the cloud space. The news is very powerful because it also can help you understand like whether or not you're also at risk if someone were to get compromised. But the good thing about it is that it also inspires the educational aspect of it, which is also very important. Like, you want to make sure that you're studying for your certifications or you're learning the security best practices that the CFPs are providing you with, you know, so you definitely want to make sure you're doing all of that. And the last thing that I would say is, from an incident response standpoint, when you're kind of building it out and attempting to get your education, right? Your tabletop exercises are exceptionally important because it's purple teaming, but you also are working with everyone in your organization to ensure that you are actually responding to the events the way you have actually documented everything. There's also playbooks and runbooks that you want to create as well. And that will better prepare you to respond effectively to any kind of incidents that you have within your cloud environment. So those are really, really good things to have to prepare yourself.
I think that would definitely strengthen the muscle memory people have around incident response in general as well. I'm glad you had a talk about this at Forward Cloud Sec that reinforced as well. That was kind of most of the questions I had, man. But I think I've got three fun questions for you so people get to know you a bit more as well. Not too technical, just to get to you a bit more. But first one being, what do you spend most time on when you're not working on cloud security or building incident response plans, man?
Oh, man. I think for me, so I have a couple of foster kittens right now, me and my partner, or my girlfriend, really. We foster cats. So that's pretty much like where the majority of my time is going, is taking care of kittens that are less than 12 weeks old. And attempting to play video games on top of that. So that's pretty much what I do with my spare time.
How many kittens are you fostering at the same time?
So we have three little kittens at this time. And we also have two cats of our own.
Yeah, fair enough.
So yeah, it's about like a house of five cats.
Well, are you going to turn into a cat man? Is that even a thing?
Like, I know, right? I'm already there, dude.
There's no going back anymore.
There's no going back.
Oh, fair enough. Oh, okay. Next question. What is something that you're proud of, but is not on your social media?
Honestly, I'm very proud to be learning martial arts. So I'm at
any particular discipline of martial art?
Tai Chi. Qigong. That is pretty much like one way for me to kind of decompress, relax, and just kind of center myself with the universe and, you know, the environment and life. And I don't necessarily share that as like one of my things on social media because I don't find the time to take pictures. Like when I go to Tai Chi practice, I could completely disconnect. My phone is somewhere outside in my car and I'm in the dojo just kind of doing my thing. So,
look, I don't think the internet wants sweaty pictures of people. Like
exactly.
You're like, oh my God. A final question. What is your favorite cuisine or restaurant that you can share?
Oh, that's tough. That's a very hard question because I'm pretty much like a big foodie. I eat so many different like dishes. It's not even funny. If I had to take a guess, honestly, and I know people in Texas who are listening to this will probably want to do something very terrible to me right now because it's not barbecue, but I would have to say it's seafood. So I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, and seafood is pretty much the staple cuisine out there. And it's something that I just can't get away from. So if any kind of crab,
lobster,
crawfish, lobster, all of that, I'm game. I'm always interested in going to get some seafood.
Would you be like a lobster chowder fan as well? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. There's lobster chowder, clam chowder. There's so many different chowders. I would say I've had them all.
Because I think New Orleans itself is very well known for food, right? I think.
Yes, very well known for food, especially their gumbo and their crawfish. Yeah, which gumbo is definitely like up there for me.
Even the beignets as well. I think we had beignets the other day. Oh my God. Like, I think we were lucky enough to find New Orleans style beignets in San Francisco. And someone, I was surprised by it. I think I can't remember the name of the place, but it was really interesting that the guests we were interviewing and people would see it kind of like a bit of a teaser for what's coming up in the coming months. But we had beignets as part of the interview. And the guy had it and he's like, oh my God, these are like New Orleans beignets. I'm like, I've never had been in New Orleans. So I'm like, for me, they're just beignets. Some of them had filling inside as well. I don't know if that's how the New Orleans ones are, but they had some like sugary filling inside with some kind of fruits in there.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. Those are really, really good. But I don't think, the last time I've been to New Orleans was about a year ago and I didn't stop to get any beignets. So I don't know. If you ever do find yourself in New Orleans and you go to Cafe Du Mont, that's pretty much like the signature beignet shop in New Orleans. They may have it. They might have it. But I always get the original one that doesn't have the filling because it's just as great. It's just
I mean, we had the non-filling one as well. I kind of personally enjoyed the, because it was my first time. I was like, oh, wow, these are really good. So now I'll leave the recommendations here as well for people to kind of comment back and see what they enjoy. But dude, that was most of the questions we had. Where can people find you to have follow-up conversations about the whole instant response? And if they walk down that path, maybe they can reach out to you as well. Where can people find you on the internet?
So I do. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. I will post my link tree in the show notes. So even if you want to have a discussion on some challenges that you're running into, if you're trying to build like AWS solutions and frameworks, connect with me on GitHub. I'll help contribute to it if you guys need something. But you can find me on social media for sure. LinkedIn is most likely the place where you will find me.
I would definitely put that in the show notes and description as well. But dude, thank you so much for coming and looking forward to hearing your talk in person as well as when it comes online. I'll definitely add that to the description as well. Thank you so much. And thank you for everyone watching as well. We'll see you in the next episode.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks.